Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, a conversation with Thomas Keller, a chef whose name is practically synonymous with haute cuisine in the United States. Keller is the first and only American chef to have two restaurants awarded three Michelin stars, the French Laundry in Yountville, California, and Per Se in New York. Keller has just written his sixth cookbook, titled The French Laundry, Per Se, a combination of recipes and essays on his culinary philosophy. On October 26, 2020, Chef Keller spoke to Amanda Hesser, co-founder of Food 52 and a former food editor at the New York Times. The two discussed his new book and how he manages to oversee and connect restaurants on opposite sides of the country. Join us now for a conversation with Thomas Keller and Amanda Hesser.
I wanted to start, Thomas, by going back quite a few years, actually, to 1997, when Ruth Reichel called the French Laundry the most exciting place to eat in America. And I remember, I think many people remember that review. It really, to me, was a defining kind of turning point in American cooking and American restaurants, because it felt like it was the first time that American restaurants were taken really as seriously as restaurants in Europe. I wondered if that was like, if that was your goal when you opened the French Laundry, and do you see it the same way? Or do you feel like that is you have a different kind of turning point in your head?
Well, first of all, thank you, Amanda, for having me here tonight. I want to thank Celia at Omnivore Books, of course, Kate and Holly at City Arts and Lectures, Artisan for their contributions to 826 Valencia. And it's a real privilege to be here. I know Chef Breeden's going to come on a little later. It's our sixth book, and we're just so proud and excited to be here. So thank you. Going to your question about Ruth's article, the most exciting restaurant to eat in America, I mean, certainly that was a moment for us, for myself, that was really of a great surprise and certainly one of great celebration at the same time. But when I think about what's happened in America and, the cuisine culture around where we started, where we are today, it began certainly before myself and before even Ruth started writing. I think as I track it back, and of course, I'm not going to go all the way back, but we look at three individuals who I think were the trilogy or the founding members of where we are today. And that was, Chuck Williams, who brought us all these tools and this wonderful store called Williams-Sonoma, which inspired and influenced so many people. I look at, of course, Robert Mondavi, 1968, who started to teach us about wine in a serious way. And we started to embrace wine, and America became a wine culture. America produced wines that were recognized around the world. And of course, Julia Child, right, who really began to teach us how to cook. Or I should say, began to teach us not to be afraid of cooking. And I think those three individuals really kind of set the foundation for things that happened after that. After that, for me, and looking back, there was a chef. There are two chefs, actually. Alice Waters, who really kind of helped reconnect us to those farmers, those fishermen, those individuals that bring us our food. She started talking about California in so many different ways and spawned this idea of California cuisine, which was about cuisine in general, just about fresh ingredients and where to get them and how to support those individuals. And for me, one of the most inspiring chefs at that time was the second person who reinforced that. That was Jean-Louis Paladin at a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel called Jean-Louis. He came here as the youngest Michelin two-star chef ever before him and opened this restaurant in Washington. And he raised a great question: where are you chefs getting your food from? And no one could answer that. And so then he gave us, Jameson Farms and Rod Mitchell, in Maine and the scallops, and he enlightened us in so many different ways, as did Alice. And that's kind of where the next kind of benchmark, you know, for this American revival in the culinary world. And then you look to the chefs in France, you know, in that time in the early 70s, and there was a cookbook. And if you talk to chefs of my generation, certainly American chefs of my generation, it's shocking how many people point to this one book as being a influencer in so many ways. And that book was The Great Chefs of France. And it wasn't so much about the recipes in the book as much it was about the lifestyle of these chefs and the enjoyment that they had, not just in their kitchens, but as colleagues in the profession in France. And that was something that was also, you know, a motivator for so many of us. So, you know, I sit here as one of the first generations or the first generation of American chefs to gain that kind of recognition. But before that, I have to take my hat off to Charlie Trotter. You know, Charlie was the first American chef to kind of hang that sign out in front of his door on Armitage Avenue in Chicago, and declared that he was going to rival the great chefs of Europe, those great restaurants. And at a very young age, I think Charlie wasn't even 30 years old then. And that was really inspiring, that a chef could actually own their own restaurant in this country. You know, before that, there weren't too many chefs that owned their own restaurants. And therein lies kind of part of the foundation of where we are today. This idea that here in America, we can do it. And it's just, I am so proud that in one generation, more or less my generation, America changed in so many different ways in their appreciation, not just of chefs, not just of restaurants, but of quality, you know, of quality food. And they don't have to be great restaurants. The really good restaurants are all around us now. They're really wonderful chefs of many different generations now all around us. The food that's available to us, you know, in our markets and our grocery stores is really extraordinary. We have so many alternatives to where we get our food from, the quality of our food, the diversity of our food. There's only one other country that kind of mirrors what America's done, and that's the UK. If you look back 50 years ago, nobody would ever, you know, claim that there was any great food in America, nor would they claim there's any great food in the UK. So we look at these parallel paths, two countries who were influenced by great chefs, primarily from France or from Europe, or, you know, from France or Italy or even from Europe, and how we wanted to be like those individuals. And that influence and inspiration really resonated with myself, my generation of American chefs. And here we are today, where Ruth Reichel can write an article about, you know, one of the greatest great meal at the greatest meal she had was at the French Laundry. And the most exciting restaurant was that restaurant. And we were really proud of that. We continue to push ourselves forward to even do a better job than we did then. And it's a wonderful privilege for me to be here representing not just our restaurants, but an entire profession, which continues to elevate our standards and therefore, you know, give ourselves, our colleagues, and most important, our guests, all of our supply chains, all of our fishermen, foragers, farmers, gardeners, this opportunity to come together for the sole purpose of nurturing each other.
So can you talk a little bit about, because you weren't aiming to be just a good chef, you were aiming to be a great chef and restaurateur. And I'm wondering, like, if you can remember back kind of like what you remember wanting to be your goal then and how that has evolved, like how you're thinking about what you're doing as a restaurateur and chef has evolved. And I think that because the reason I'm asking this is because I think, you know, creative people are always responding to the environments that they're in. Right. And it can be like sort of larger, you know, social movements. It can be just, you know, new knowledge that comes to them. My guess is that like what you aimed to do then has changed over time. And I think also probably because you're so focused on the guest is, their expectations have probably changed too over time. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit about how your, you know, what you set out to achieve and like what your goals are have evolved over time?
Sure. Thank you. It's a great question. And, you know, I never thought that I would, you know, as a younger person, you know, finishing high school and trying to get into college and do those, that kind of stuff and trying to support myself. I never really thought I would become a chef. My mother ran restaurants, so I spent a lot of time as the youngest of six children in the restaurant. But it wasn't something that, you know, I had ambitions for. I'd much rather had played baseball, but I couldn't play baseball well enough to really see myself going down that path. But I found that same kind of environment in the kitchen. There were so many, you know, there's so many different stations. Like if you have a baseball team, there are all these different positions. Same thing in the kitchen. Each person has a different discipline. So that was very exciting to me to see that it was a true team. We all had one goal, which was to give the guests a wonderful experience. But it wasn't until the summer of July 1977 when I was working as the family cook or the employee cook in a private club in Narragansett, Rhode Island. When the chef asked me a simple question, he asked me, Thomas, why do you think cooks cook? And of course, I fumbled for some answer and I couldn't really articulate anything. And he responded, he said, we cook to nurture people. And that really resonated with me. And that was the day that I decided to embrace this profession. And Roland Henin was his name. He became my mentor. He was French. So it became apparent to me that that is what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a French chef. I wanted to work in that realm. I wanted to work in that métier. I wanted to go to France, learn as much as I could. So from that moment on, I was just consuming as much as I could about history of France, the culinary world of France, the chefs of France, the restaurants of France, and that's what drove me to the point of having my own restaurant. I always felt that I was an entrepreneur. So the French Olive was actually my third restaurant. My first two failed, but I kept at it. I kept being persistent, knowing that one day I could achieve what I wanted to achieve. And I found, of course, the French Olive in 1992 and opened in 1994. But for me, it was just about having a modest restaurant in Napa Valley where I could do the food that I felt was meaningful to me and then hopefully be meaningful to our guests. And we're in Napa Valley, so you know our flavor profiles have to kind of married with wine. So we have to be careful on those flavor profiles and making sure that the guests that come here can enjoy their wine with their food. But it was an evolution. The French Laundry began with basically 12 of us in the restaurant, and now today it's over 120, so 10 times as many people. But the purpose is the same. The purpose is the same, is to nurture our guests, but also nurture ourselves by working together in a collaborative environment, one that is also a teaching environment, a mentoring environment. We nurture ourselves. You talked about expectations a little bit. One of my first mistakes in my restaurant, my first restaurant in New York City, was trying to really look to other people's expectations to try to deliver to their expectations of what they wanted. And it was all over the place. And so I didn't really succeed trying to live up to others' expectations. By the time I got to the French Laundry, it was about my expectations and then our expectations and trying to live up to our expectations. So I truly believe if we can live up to our expectations or at least be 90%, that most of our guests or all of our guests will also be happy with their experience.
And how do you feel your cooking has changed over the years at the, you know, both at, you know, the French Laundry and per se? And maybe you could also, sorry, a question within a question, maybe just describe for the audience, like how you would define the differences between the two restaurants.
So of course, you know, per se was born from the French Laundry. In 1994, you know, I purchased the French Laundry. We opened it with this idea of doing a tasting menu, using ingredients that were of exceptional quality, and producing food again that went well with wine. And it was a menu that changed every day, and I think that was a significant decision. And that happened on the second night we were open, to change the menu every day. And from that point on, it's been a collaboration with the culinary team, with our gardeners, and sometimes with with some of our dining room team or some of our sommeliers who may have an idea about combinations and that flavor profiles for specific things. So it's always been that evolutionary process. So for me, it's never been about one chef. It's been about a group of chefs focused on collaboration and developing flavor profiles, compositions that represented the food. And of course, the food that we get or the food that we work with is food from exceptional suppliers. So they're literally our partners in that. So this idea of a philosophy around food comes from the freshest ingredients that we can possibly get, supporting those fishermen or those farmers or the foragers, as I said before, working in a team environment and collaboration to continually evolve our cuisine, but also stay true to classic representations of flavor profiles. Again, very important to us. And a lot of that is within the scope of Europe, whether it's mostly French or some Italian or even some Spanish, ultimately getting to introduce a few techniques from Asia as well. But primarily the focus is to making sure that it is a combination and clarifying the purpose of the food is to be enjoyed with wine. And that's something that I can't emphasize enough, because we are in the premier wine growing region in America. The evolution of our food is continuous, and it comes into impact in small ways. I mean, if you take the coronet, which began simply with the cracker, the tuile, the creme fraiche, the sweet onions, and the salmon tartare, which is primarily a very logical flavor profile, something that we recognize, something we have reference points to. It's smoked salmon on cracker with cream cheese. But represented in a different form that helps, that gives you a smile, that kind of pleases you, that surprises you. And so our food has been a little bit about that as well. But again, using those primary components. And then watching David or Corey, evolve that simple coronet into something that's different, but as easily as recognizable as the salmon on a cracker with sour cream or with whipped cream and onions. So that's that part of that evolution we use the same principles, the same philosophy, but we're adding continuously through the representation of the ideas of those around us to continue to evolve the food.
You talk about in the book, you talk about inspiration versus influence. Is that?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that now?
Well, I realize this, I used to use the word inspired a lot. And of course, a lot of people use how inspired they are by what they see me do. And I realize that that's not so much inspiration as influencing. We pick up a cookbook and we look through it and we love what we see in the pictures or what we read. And we feel we're inspired by that. And yeah, there's a certain amount of inspiration, but it's more influence. You're influenced by what you're reading, by what you're seeing. I think true inspiration happens rarely in your life, and inspiration happens through a sense of acute awareness. And the example of that is the oysters and pearls. Being open to the world around you and being aware of that world, so that when you see something that may catch your eye, you could potentially be inspired by it. And that had to do with the purple box of tapioca, which inspired the oysters and pearls. Because when I saw that box, it was a purple box, number one, which is not necessarily a food color, not necessarily a color associated with food you see in a grocery store, it caught my eye. And it was a box of pearl tapioca. And where do pearls come from? They come from oysters. So, I took the tapioca, the box of tapioca, and came back to the restaurant. And knowing that, knowing the reference points to tapioca pudding as a dessert in America and around the world, converting that into a savory pudding, which was very easy to do. And then, of course, putting the on top of the tapioca pearl, the pearl tapioca, poached oysters. And then on top of that, makes it very luxurious, the caviar, the eggs. So you have this wonderful dish, which has a reference point in the tapioca pudding, understanding the quality of the oysters and the caviar as it relates to the luxurious texture that it brings into and the salinity and the flavors of those, and the small amount of it, it creates this wonderful kind of 2-3 bite dish that to me is a perfect opening course, because now you get to enjoy it with champagne. And what better way to celebrate you know, the opening of your of a meal than with something that's luxurious, something that has this sense of luxury with the caviar, yet has reference points with tapioca pudding to be enjoyed with a beautiful sparkling wine or champagne.
Sounds good to me. If I'm hearing you right, like inspiration is something that happens quite rarely. Influence is something that's kind of all around us and we're taking in at all times.
That's correct. You know, again, you know, reading the French Laundry cookbook, some people can think that they're inspired by it, but you know, these are things that are going to be influencing you, and they're influencing you in ways that you'll appreciate and be able to then either take it verbatim, you know, and do that recipe, or be influenced to modify a recipe that you already know in ways through techniques or through skills or through some type of equipment or tools that we're using.
I want to come back to the book and your other books as well in a moment, but how do you nurture that creative freedom in your kitchens when you have a menu to deliver and to get right every day, but how do you create an environment of kind of freedom of expression in your kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, it's just that, and you know, if you look at our chefs that are in our restaurants today, if you look at Corey Chow or David Breeden, you know, they've been with us for quite some time, and so they were brought up in their careers in those two restaurants, and so you know, from an early stage, you could understand, you could see that they embraced this philosophy, that this understanding about food, and they wanted to pursue that specific style of food. Now, you know, today, as opposed to when I was much younger, there wasn't as much diversity in what we were doing in restaurants. You either would find dining, French, Italian. Today, you have so much diversity in your ability to choose exactly the style of food, the style of restaurant, the style of kitchen that you want to work in. There's such an abundance of variation out there today, and it's beautiful to see all of that. Whereas, then a chef who comes into the French Laundry, he's going to recognize what we do. He's going to feel that it's something that he wants to continue to pursue, and then it's up to us to continue to train them and to mentor them, so that they have the ability then to not just understand the philosophy, but to actually produce it and teach it to others, and that's an important thing. So if you look at it as a again, sports franchise is a very important analogy for myself, and I look at it as I'm really running a sports franchise, whether it's a baseball team or a football team. You know, we have you know, different teams. You have the dining room team, you have the kitchen team, you have special teams in the wine team, or the reservations team. I mean, there's all these different teams that come together to work in this wonderful way. And so once we understand that the individual is a person that wants to continue to develop their skill levels and disciplines around our philosophy, then that's a person that we feel is going to stay. And so we're working on developing them as potentially the next franchise player, if you will, or the next sous chef, or the next executive sous chef, or the next chef de cuisine, or the next sommelier, or the next general manager. In any team, we're looking at this in the same way. It's not just the culinary team. It's a restaurant. It needs each one of those teams, and each one of those teams needs those individuals that are going to lead those teams in a way that's going to elevate the experience for the guest in a seamless way. You know, there's not one team member that's more important than another. They're each one of them in their own right is as important as the next person, including our porters, who run our dish stations and our pot stations. They are important. So this idea that, you know, we bring them in, we hire somebody, and hiring is such an important part of the process. We want to make sure that we're hiring the right person, and the person we're hiring also feels that it's the right place for them to work. And that's really the fundamental process in the beginning, is to make sure that we bring in the right people and that we're committing to them 100%. You don't commit to a new hire 70% or 80%. You have to commit to that person 100%, give them everything that they need so that they can be successful. And then it's the training part. Training is such a critical part, and training goes on forever, right? I mean, those of you who have children, you know, when you're teaching your child how to swim and, you know, you have the floaties on their arms, you don't take them off 2 weeks and say, now you know how to swim. And if the kid drowns, it's his fault because he didn't learn. No, you leave those floaties on, you know, for months after he's learned, just to make sure that he knows how to swim. And training continuously, especially in our restaurants where everything is such a, you know, it's such a seasonal element. It's season. When I talk about seasons, it's not just talking about spring, summer, fall, winter. It's talking about how long the fava beans in season, how long the strawberries are in season. Each ingredient has its own season, its own peak of that moment during the season. And then mentoring. Mentoring becomes the third stage in that process. And if you mentor them correctly, both in their careers and in their life, then what you have is somebody who is in complete sync with your philosophy and your culture. And if you do those three things exceptionally well, what happens? What happens is they become better than you. Because if they're not better than you, then you haven't done a good job yourself. And I'm really proud to say that, you know, I look at my younger chefs, right, the next generation, and not just the chefs that work for me, but chefs around the country who have been able to work in not just our restaurants, but my colleagues' restaurants, and understand what it takes to do the job and embrace that. And do it to a level that's higher than the previous generation.
So given that, I think people would love to hear how you spend your time. Like what did today look like for you?
Well, I got up quite early today because I had to get things started in order to make sure that I had time to do this. So, you know, my day begins with, you know, a cup of coffee and a couple hard boiled eggs and some olive oil. That's how my day typically begins, and then I'm in my office, and I live very close to work, so I'm in my office, you know, making sure that I'm responding to the emails I need to respond to. And anybody who said emails makes your life easier, I'd argue that point. You know, I spend an extra couple hours a day that I didn't spend, you know, 15 years ago, just corresponding with emails or text messaging or things like that, making sure that. Yeah, I want to be approachable. So, you know, I have an open door policy, whether it's with my staff or with others. So I want to make sure that I'm being respectful in responding to those things. And then there was meetings this morning with our CEO, with our marketing team, you know, getting ready for the book tour. We're launching the book tomorrow. So we're really proud of doing that. It's a very exciting moment for us. And then spending time in the kitchen with David and the team, in and out of the kitchen, constantly most of the day. And then I had an hour and a half in between finishing up, visiting some of the guests who were at the restaurant early, and I took a break and had a quick workout, and now I'm sitting here with you. And then when I'm done with you, I'll go back to work as will David. I was talking to a friend in LA who has a normal lifestyle where he's off at 5:30, and he called me to get some information. And I said, I don't have much time because I got to go to work. And he, you know, he understands what I do, but it sounds funny that at 5:30 in the evening, you're saying you have to go to work, you know, after working most of the day. Yeah. But honestly, that is the joy of my life, being able to go to the restaurant, and especially in this time. With the situations that we're facing, and to see our guests, just, you know, see our guests, see our staff, see our team, see everybody, you know, just together and having a wonderful time, whether you're serving the guests, cooking for the guests, and then the guests themselves. I mean, it's very special right now to be in our restaurant. And when I say in our restaurants, it's outside of our restaurant, so we're not really inside our restaurant.
You've said that you've read the obituary for fine dining many, yeah, many times over the decades. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that. And I mean, I think also just I think people forget that there, you know, when there are these sort of strong shifts in American food, it's really because there's so much enthusiasm and interest. And it's in my view, it's just kind of constantly evolving in this in many great ways. But I'm just wondering, you know, given that sort of constant evolution and then blended with this you know sort of terrible situation we're all in, and how and the huge impact it's obviously had on restaurants. I'm just wondering, you know, what how you're thinking about, you know, not only the future of your own restaurants, but, you know, sort of throughout the business, and you know, what you and your other chef and restaurateur friends are talking about. I think it would be great to hear what you think is coming down the pike in the months and years to come.
But it's a really good question. You know, honestly, I'm terrified. I'm terrified for all restaurateurs, all chefs out there today, and certainly the smallest are the ones that I worry about the most. And you know, there are close to 1 million restaurants in America. There are roughly, you know, 400,000 who produce less than $1 million in revenue a year, and which that means is there's, you know, a husband and wife, or a husband, or, you know, a young family, or, you know, a family that's just moved here from another country and opening a restaurant, and that's their livelihood. They go to work every day to make enough money to survive. And, you know, those are the restaurants that, you know, if you're in New York City, you walk a block and you've walked by three of them without even noticing them, right? But those are the fabrics of our community. Those are the fabric of our communities. Those are the restaurants that, you know, that supply the locals, the neighbors, with their coffee in the morning or their sandwich during lunch, or takeout, you know, in the evening. I'm really afraid for those restaurants as much as I'm afraid for our restaurants. We just don't know what's going to happen here. So, you know, we have to make sure that we're being responsible to what we're doing. And so, you know, opening our restaurants was something that we were very eager to do as soon as possible. We also understood that we had to prepare for that. We had to approach it in a different way so that everybody felt safe, not just our guests, but all of our staff as well. And that's the, you know, that was really the motivating part, was making sure that everybody feels safe. Because if they feel safe, and they'll be comfortable, and then they'll enjoy their experience. And it doesn't matter if it's at a fine dining restaurant or a casual restaurant, you know, it's just about a sense of comfort. And that comfort comes from the security that the people who are running the restaurant are taking care of you. What's going to happen in the future? You know, it's an unknown. And I think what we have to do is be prepared and be strong enough to make sure that we do everything we can to weather through this storm and protect our businesses and protect our restaurants and protect our team. We are offering to the community a place to find refuge. You know, a restaurant is a place to find refuge, restoration. I mean, this is what a restaurant is all about, regardless of how expensive it is.
It almost makes me wonder if in some ways this will kind of give will revive fine dining in some way, or a new way, because people will have a sort of renewed appreciation for that sort of moment to like really sit down and be, you know, kind of treated nicely.
I don't think fine dining was ever really in jeopardy in any moment here. I think that, you know, it's this knee jerk reaction when something happens, whether it's, you know, the stock market crash or some catastrophe. It's always, will people go to fine dining? Why, you know, people go to restaurants all the time. And I think that, you know, the fact that in America now we have, you know, so many different options about being able to eat out, why would we want to eliminate one of them? That just wouldn't make sense to me. You know, there was this idea that young people, the next generations, won't really embrace the experience of fine dining. Yet I was curious. We did that at Per Se, where, you know, we offered several years ago, and we do it a couple of times a year. You have to be under 30 years of age to get a reservation. And the demand was so intense that, you know, I think we've kept that waiting list for quite some time and just used them over and over again. You know, here at French Laundry, you know, our whole demographic changed when we reopened the restaurant, and we offered, you know, reservations that were online, so that they didn't have to get on a phone. You know, the younger generations don't like to get on the phone and try to make a reservation. They do everything through a smartphone. So when we shifted to smartphone technology for reservations, we saw, it was shocking. It was literally shocking to me overnight. You know, the age dropped by, you know, 15 years, and it was extraordinary, the amount of young people. So it's like, and sometimes the media is saying, well, the young people are not interested, the Gen X, or, you know, the millennials aren't interested in fine dining. But I contrary to what they say, they're all over the restaurants now. So, and it's not just our restaurant either. I know Danielle or Jean-Georges or, you know, Eric Repair. It's an aspirational thing. It's an experience. And it's something that I think everybody should experience. It's a fabulous moment in time where you can sit down and have that kind of, you know, in that kind of experience with in those individuals who are at the top of their game, the top of their profession, with the best ingredients available, taking care of you and nurturing you.
I'd love to turn the conversation now to the book and also welcome Chef David Breeden. I do want to pause for one second because I realized I forgot to do something in the beginning, which is to just sort of let everyone know that if we will be taking audience questions and they'll be collecting the questions and I'll be turning it over to audience questions in about 10 minutes. But first, I'd love to welcome Chef David Breeden, who is the chef de cuisine at the French Laundry.
There he is.
Oh, there he is. Hi.
See, we both have COVID beards.
I was going to say.
neither one of us had beards. And you can't really tell. You can tell David's beard with his mask on. But if I put my mask on, you can't really tell I have a beard.
Oh, right. Yeah. So. I was going to say, yeah, you'd look different from your photos in the book. So I'd love to talk about the book. It seems, so there are 70 kind of French Laundry per se classics in the book, as well as 40 recipes that are sort of more geared towards a home cook, or maybe more doable by a home cook. The others are sort of more ambitious restaurant style recipes. I mean, I think that you proved with your first book that home cooks are not afraid of trying your you know, most challenging recipes. In fact, I remember when the French Laundry cookbook came out, there were all sorts of blogs where people were cooking every recipe in the book and keeping a journal of it. And they had sort of rabid fans following along. One of the things that I have really long appreciated about your books, though, is that while if you're a really motivated and aspirational home chef, you can take on those, you know, the full recipes. But there's always, I have found that throughout your books, there are always nuggets within the recipes, layered within the recipes, that if you can, you know, kind of pluck them out, you can really change the way you cook. And I'm just going to give a couple of examples that have like had a big impact on me for many years. Particularly from the Bouchon cookbook, where there's a recipe for duck confit. And, you know, I've made many duck confit recipes, and this one really was transformative. And the reason is because it used this technique where you ground all of the herbs in with the salt in a coffee grinder, you know, one of those little burr grinders. And you get this moss green, like very fine salt that you season the duck with, and it so then it gets fully all the duck gets fully perfumed and absorbs all of the flavor of the herbs, and it's really incredible.
Very evenly.
Yes, very evenly. And so and it was one of those aha moments as a home cook who, you know, I'm not making duck confit every night, but it made me think, well, anytime I do any kind of dry brining or confiting, I'm going to do it this way from now on. And I feel like your books are filled with those kinds of details. And I haven't had a chance to cook out of this one, but you know, one of the things that leapt out to me was something was the kale aioli. You know, it's a pretty classic, but you know, you take this one extra step that, you know, pulls the essence of kale out of it and makes it this, you know, this great recipe. So I was hoping you could maybe just talk about how you were approaching this book compared to the many books you've done before and what you were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, thank you. First, I just want to point out, you know, again, the those involved in the book, and, you know, certainly, you know, Corey Chow, the Chef Breeden here, Ellen Boyles, who I think, you know, is still today one of the best pastry chefs, you know, in the world, and somebody I just adore and does a great job. You know, Elaine Smythe, you know, who was the assistant to Corey, and she worked tirelessly to make sure those recipes worked. She, you know, she was on the culinary team for a long time and then decided to transition to administration. Allison Beasley, our sous chef here, who's David's sous chef at the French Laundry, again, filling the role that Elaine did for Corey. And making sure that David stayed on track with all the recipes. And of course, Susie Heller, you know, who's always been our producer. Susie and I met when she was working with Julia Child on one of her shows and been friends ever since. Deborah Jones, who's been our photographer since day one, who told me when I first called her back in 1996 that she would never do a cookbook. And now this is her sixth one with us. And of course, Michael Ruhlman, who I've loved his writing, not just his book about culinary, but every book that he's written, and the stories that he tells. So Michael's been a big part of our, so that's kind of been our team, and I'm very appreciative of that. You are so right when you say there are so many different little nuggets here, that you can use to, change the way you cook. And you point out, you know, the brining and, you know, brining and curing of any protein, and sometimes, you know, really adds another dimension of flavor when you actually cook it. So those are great things that we do. We talk about, you know, tempering to specific temperatures, how important that is in your cooking, and how that'll change the outcome, the results of anything that you're cooking, that you want to make sure that you temper your food. And certainly we talk about proteins and tempering in that way. So I love that you pointed out the kale aioli, which was one of Susie's first recipes that she attempted. And she came back with, you know, with this glow about her and saying how wonderful this was and how easy it was and how now she's going to make it all the time for everything. And I think she does. It's just a perfect example of a cookbook that has so many different layers. Yes, you know, to try to accomplish some of the recipes may be daunting, and not necessarily would I suggest that you try that. But there are so many different techniques and recipes within the recipes that really will change so many things about the way you cook and your opportunity to have different flavor profiles, different textures. And I think those are wonderful things that you can learn from this book, even if you don't attempt to do the chicken confit recipe. Good. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of little tidbits, little gems kind of hidden throughout. And I really like that style of cooking as well. When you can kind of take a little piece of this, a little piece of that, and put it together. I've never cooked at home specifically from a recipe or a specific dish end to end, because I find it hard sometimes to gather all those same ingredients. So ultimately the market's going to decide whatever you're making anyhow. And the sauces, the presentations, or those kind of protein-based items, those are the little items you can kind of pick and pull. I certainly agree with that.
You know, eggs are one of my favorite thing, and just learning how to soft boil in an egg, you know, it's one of those pure pleasures, whatever you put it with, right? You know, I told you I eat eggs every morning for breakfast, and you know, the technique of soft boiling the hen egg and how that comes out, it's just beautiful. You know, we put it with a puree of spinach and sauce sous vide and then shaved white truffles on top. It's a very elegant dish. But really just learning how to soft boil that egg, you know, that's a delight in itself.
Or shaved button mushrooms.
Right.
It's still beautiful.
Yeah.
So Chef Breeden, if you could maybe tell us a bit about how, you know, your journey to becoming a chef. It sounds like, I mean, you've done everything, including dishwashing, in restaurants. I think people would like to hear how you go from that to being the chef de cuisine at French Laundry.
Well, I think that's kind of a natural progression. You sometimes you don't pick the job picks you, you know? So it's easy to get in as a dishwasher when you're young. You fall in love with the romance of the restaurant. The energy, the aromas, the speed, the service. It's just, I mean, who doesn't like to eat too, right? So you always, as the dishwasher, you're the best fed person in the house. So I think that for me was the initial, I fell in love with the energy. I think my first job washing dishes, I got so I could buy skateboards. I was convinced I was going to be a professional skateboarder. And quickly, I learned that wasn't going to happen, and I should continue with the cooking. So
it's funny how we always wanted to be athletes, and we realized early on that we could be athletes, and we gravitated to kitchens.
Yeah, it's athletic as well. Yeah.
No, I mean, cooking is very athletic.
To your point, it's there. Yeah, and well, it's very much like a team sport, getting the food out to diners, right?
A little funny anecdote is I used to think, it was one of those epiphany moments. I used to think that I was such an anti-team sports person because I was a skateboarder. It's very individual, right? You're kind of by yourself or with a couple of friends, and you have your style, you do your thing. It's your success. It's everything's all you. And when I found the kitchen and realized what I had been missing out on that whole time, because I had a coach, I had a mentor, I had teammates, I had direct reports who I had to manage. I had people, you know, it was just this amazing kind of solar system of humans that we would all interact in such a way. And the symphony of service, if you want to talk about team, the symphony of service with everything working together, all just kind of connecting, taking direction, giving direction, executing tasks. I mean, it's such a wonderful feeling to be a part of that team, you know, in all the restaurants. They all kind of operate in a very similar way.
Yeah. I love that image of the solar system of humans. I think this might be a good moment for us to actually go to audience questions. So I am going to just give me one moment. See if I can get this right. Great. Okay. So with this summer's racial awakening, how do you elevate the Mexican-American team members you know and love?
Okay. Well, it's not, you know, it's interesting because we think about just this moment in time, but, you know, this is something that we have worked on, you know, since I can remember in terms of who gets elevated in our kitchen or in our dining room, on our wine teams. And it's, you know, whoever's doing the job, whoever shows interest, whoever has the aspiration, whoever shows the desire, right? People talk about passion, but it's about desire. And we see this, you know, all over the place. You know, I'll talk about Octavio Alcatar, who was a young 18-year-old in 1994 when we opened the restaurant, just out of juvenile detention. And he got a job as a dishwasher at the French Laundry. And Octavio was a delight. He wanted to succeed. He didn't want to be, you know, somebody that was in trouble. Although he had some trouble during his teenage portion of his life. And Octavio has been with us off and on since 1996. He took a short break, went to work for a chef who honed his skills at the French Laundry and then opened a restaurant in Sonoma. By that time, Octavio was a pastry sous chef under Stephen Durfee. And Octavio went with Ryan to Sonoma and became his pastry chef. Ultimately, Octavio came back, you know, to the French Laundry, and now he's working at the bakery as the head bread baker under Francois Hagel at Bouchon. So, you know, it's interesting how Octavio's career path has exemplified the opportunities that he had, and more important, the opportunities that he embraced, his desire to learn, his persistence, his patience, his determination, all of those things took him to a place where, you know, he's back in Yountville with his family of his wife and his three children. Two of them have graduated from college. And he's one of the most respected staff members, team members that we have. And he's not the only one. If we want to just talk about Hispanics, or we have a young sous chef, well, not young anymore, but a sous chef in Las Vegas who began at the French Laundry as a dishwasher. So there, you know, dishwashing. I began as a dishwasher. David Breen began as a dishwasher. It's not a bad thing to begin as a dishwasher. I still find a lot of solace going back there and helping the dishwashers, you know, rack the dishes when they're really busy. It still brings me back to, you know, a time in life which was obviously simpler for me. But, you know, the opportunities are there. And it doesn't really matter what ethnic background that you have. There's a gentleman that's been with me, Philip Sales, who's been with me since my time in New York at Restaurant Raphael, which I think goes back to 1985. He works with David every day as one of our sous chefs at the French Laundry. Philip left me after Raquel, and was actually incarcerated for a decade. And then on our launch of Bouchon Bakery, I was doing a book tour in New York at Williams-Sonoma at the Time Warner Center. I get a tap on my shoulder and I turn around, it's Philip Sales. I said, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you since you left Raquel." And he told me a story. I said, "Well, come to California." And he moved out here and he's been with us at the French Laundry. He's worked at Ad Hoc, worked at the bakery. Now he's a sous chef at the French Laundry. So an African-American man who's just so determined every day to do a good job. That's what he wants to do. He wants to make those around him proud. He wants to teach the younger people. He knows me. He knows me the longest of anybody in my entire life right now, other than my family or some other special friends. Philip's always been there. It's interesting. There's a picture in my office, or actually in the office at the French Laundry, was done by the gentleman who used to do the artwork for Gourmet magazine. If you remember the articles that were about restaurants, there was a watercolor, Marvin, somebody who used to do the watercolors. Well, he captured a picture of me in the kitchen of Raquel with Philip Sales walking by me. He gave me that watercolor as a gift after the article came out. And I framed it. It's been in the office of the French Laundry for the past 26 years. So every day I walk into the office of the French Laundry, I saw Philip Sales. And now he's back. It's about opportunity. It's about taking the step, moving forward, having confidence, asking the questions, being determined. It's open for everybody. The restaurant profession is an extraordinary place. It offers opportunities for everybody. Many times your first job is in a restaurant. You know, it's 16 or 17 years old working in a McDonald's. Second chance, as Philip was. He had a second chance back in our restaurant. He took it. So many people have second chances in restaurants. And then, the last job that you have sometimes is in a restaurant. There are so many of our retirees who, are working in restaurants just to augment their Social Security. We are the largest employer in the country behind the U.S. government. We employ more women besides the U.S. government. The ethnic diversity in restaurants is a true example of everybody. It's just such a welcoming place, and it really pains me when I see how some of the articles, portrayed some of our restaurants as hostile places to work in, and they're sometimes intense. But I imagine a operating room sometimes can be intense as well. And what we're trying to do is always deliver to our guests a great experience, and when we're all working together, it's a beautiful thing, as David points out, and we work hard to make that happen, and everybody is committed to that. So it's restaurants, not just kitchens, but restaurants in general are really a great opportunity for anybody who wants to be part of that team.
Another question, have you and your team had an opportunity to experiment even more than usual during the downtime of the pandemic? Any surprise discoveries during this period?
David, you want to field that one?
I have a good note for that. So we love a good challenge. A challenge is an opportunity to exceed kind of your own expectations, to grow out of your comfort zone. So we closed the restaurant and a few of us went to Ad Hoc and we're going to feed the community. So typically we have, 85 or 100 guests a night. The batch sizes of recipes are somewhat smaller. Well, all of a sudden we go to feeding 500 people a day. I can't tell you how small that change, very small change, taught me so many lessons about cookery, because the way you cook for 500 people is absolutely different than the way you do for 100 people. So the size of the equipment is different. The quantity of ingredients obviously is different, but you have to cook in a more intuitive way. You don't roast carrots in a saute pan. You roast them in the oven. And something so small as that kind of makes you look at it and reevaluate certain things. I mean, the last time I roasted carrots in the oven on a sheet tray was 20 years ago. But even tonight on the menu at the French Laundry, we have a vegetable component of carrots. And this was a realization from that very thing, of carrots that are roasted on a sheet tray and then until they're just crispy on the outside and almost dehydrated. And then we grind them through a grinder. We make a little bit of bechamel from carrot juice and mix it back together. So it's this really roasted flavor, really raw flavor together. And we make these beautiful little roasted carrot marbles that go with the lamb dish tonight. And that would have never happened had we not prepared the meals at Ad Hoc for all those the members of the community around us and our team members. So I think, like Chef always teaches us, we have to be aware. We're always looking. We have our eyes open. We don't walk around with blinders on, and we think about the food that we prepare. We look for those little nuances.
That's great. Thank you. Okay, last question. And I'm sure you've been asked this before, but it's there's always people wanting to hear more about this, myself included. What advice would you give a young chef looking to hone their skills in the profession today?
Yeah, I'll answer. Then I'll let David answer it as well, because he deals with a lot of young chefs as well. So it is a question I've answered before, whether it's at one of the colleges or job fairs or just to people who are interested in understanding what it is that they could do. And I think there are two words I like to go to. Number one is patience. Be patient with yourself. We are, as young people, we are always in such a hurry to accomplish and move on to the next. This is cooking. You're going to be cooking for the rest of your life. So enjoy the moment. Enjoy the moment. When you're a commis and you're dicing vegetables, that's a moment in your career that you should savor. And be patient that, if you do that really, really well, you'll be recognized in being able to do the next thing is slice the carrots, right? From dicing them to slicing them. These are things that, that require patience in your career. Don't always try to elevate yourself beyond your capacity at the moment that you want to, because that ambition that you have, sometimes you need to just quite quell that ambition just a little bit. You want to show that you're ambitious. You want your chef to see that, but you also want your chef to see that you're patient and you'll bide your time and you'll do the job every day. If it's dicing carrots every day, you'll do that job with the same resolve as you did the first day, and that's an important thing. You'll get there, if you continue. And the important thing that you'll find is that you'll have honed your skills so well that not only will you be able to dice the carrots anytime, but you'll be able to teach somebody how to do that. You'll be able to talk about it. You'll be able to explain it, the reasons why that you need to do those things. So that's important to be patient. Be patient with the successes or the failures that you have. We'll learn more from your failures than you will from your successes. So embrace those failures. Be patient that you can get it right, right? Just because you failed at sauteing that piece of fish today doesn't mean, tomorrow is going to be the same. Come back tomorrow with the same intensity as you have with the fish. So patience is an important word. And then persistence. Don't let anybody tell you you cannot do something. You can do anything that you want. I sit here today because of my persistence, mostly because I've always wanted to do this. I found a way to achieve everything that I wanted to achieve. And in many ways has led me down to achieve things I never thought I would achieve. So I think those are two words that I would look to as patience and persistence. David?
I absolutely agree with you. And I think another portion, just directly for the for the applicants is that we have a philosophy of attitude over ability. If you've got the winning attitude, you're trainable, you're coachable, you can take direction. Those are the attributes we're really looking for. The resume that's a mile long isn't always the best applicant if they don't have the right attitude. And you have to be able to be a team member. You have to be able to work with your peers in a meaningful way, and just be kind of along for the ride in the beginning. Be able to come onto the team and take direction, learn these new things, embrace them, kind of evolve with the team.
That's all terrific advice. I was taking notes. I think it applies to all sorts of endeavors. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you to the audience again. And I also wanted to give a shout out to Omnivore Books, where you can get The French Laundry Per Se, and probably all of your other books as well. And it's a great store, and hope you'll support it. And thanks to City Arts and Lectures for having all of us tonight. And we hope you'll check out the book tomorrow.
Can I just add something? If I can, do I have a few more minutes, Amanda, or we got to rush? Got to go.
Oh, sure.
I just want to thank everybody, you know, because people are saying, what can I do for restaurants? You know, how can I support them? And that's just it. You know, whatever you can do, you know, in your community to support any restaurant that's there, you know, I know that they're going to appreciate it. And that's what we need to do right now, is to support our communities and those individuals in our communities. And as we know, you know, restaurants are one of the largest employers in any community. And so, you know, being able to support a restaurant is meaningful, not just for those employees at the restaurant, but you all understand the supply chain. And, you know, there are so many others that are involved in preparing a meal for you. You know, all of our, as I've said this before, all of our farmers, our fishermen, our foragers, our gardeners, you know, even our linen supply or florists, you know, our gardeners, I mean, our maintenance men. I mean, everybody who comes into contact with a restaurant and supports that restaurant is endeavoring to do well. And you supporting the restaurant is going to help support that entire community. So please support your local restaurants.
You've been listening to Chef Thomas Keller in conversation with Amanda Hesser. This program was recorded on October 26th, 2020. The two spoke to one another via video conference. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Rondazzo. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckerd. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The Founding Producer is Sydney Goldstein. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.